We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, December 10th, and, you know, two really fascinating stories that I think we have to kind of take a step back and look at what is going on in our culture that has led to the public response and even how we got here. So we're going to kind of take a worldview deep dive this morning, which I know is generally what we do on some of our Friday shows. But this relates to two of the biggest stories in the news right now, which is, of course, the acquittal and the justice that was provided, thankfully, through a Manhattan jury to Daniel Penny, who is the 26-year-old Marine who was acquitted yesterday of criminally negligent homicide in the death of the homeless 30-year-old man with a history of mental illness, whose final moments on that subway train were threatening not only his own life, but other fellow passengers. And not 10 days or so after this incident, Alvin Bragg, yeah, remember him? That prosecutor brought charges seemingly in response to the racial outrage that was going on in the city, because, of course, Penny is a white man, and Jordan Neely, who was the man on the subway who was threatening people, was a black man. And so inevitably, everybody who wanted to make this about race made this about race. And after the acquittal yesterday, which really was justice, and after the prosecutor tried to really manipulate the jury when they were hung jury on that first higher charge of manslaughter, and so the DA said, okay, we're gonna just dismiss that charge and let's go after the criminally negligent homicide, bring back the jury Monday. It only took them an hour to say, yeah, no go. So then, of course, the race baiters come out and respond instead of recognizing, even if they disagreed with the verdict. Now, I've disagreed, you know, as both a prosecutor, a defense attorney, and then even as just a voting member of the public with different verdicts from juries. You still recognize that is our process. It is not about vigilante justice. It's not about race baiting. And it certainly isn't about cultural Marxism. But of course, that's exactly where BLM went right after this acquittal. And this is what one of the BLM leaders actually said yesterday on the courthouse steps. Listen to this, cut three.
Just like everybody else has vigilantes, we need some black vigilantes.
That's right.
People want to jump up and choke us and kill us for being loud. How about we do the same when they attempt to oppress us?
Right.
I'm tired.
Tired.
I know y'all looking for us to be like, tired. Oh, go and march. Go and march. No. This weekend, I want you to hold a community event everywhere from the Bronx to Houston to Seattle to Florida. Black people, hold community event and talk about what you need.
All right. So first of all, he's suggesting that somehow this was about Jordan Neely being loud. I mean, I'm loud, and I don't see anybody putting me in a chokehold. I mean, that's just utterly ridiculous in this whole situation. But the left and BLM specifically seem to think that if they put the adjective black in front of criminal or immoral actions, then they're somehow justified in calling for this type of response. So black vigilante action is no different than regular vigilante action. And this, in this country, we have law and order. And the reason that I can confidently say that is because that is exactly the same posture that I'm taking and any rational person is taking with the cold-blooded killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO last week. And this was allegedly done, and there's now a suspect in custody, who is white, by the way, maybe Italian, but, you know, definitely not a black man who went and killed a white person. So this has nothing to do about race, right? This has everything to do with ideology, and it is setting up cultural Marxism, oppressor versus oppressed. In both of these situations, just one happens to be around race, and the other happens to be around the greedy corporate healthcare industry that, you know, these big bad companies don't care about you, don't care about your family. And so in both scenarios, the left and cultural Marxists are suggesting that vigilante justice is appropriate, not the system, not law and order, not policy, not lobbying, not, you know, advocating through proper channels, you know, none of this, not lawsuits, none of the process. And this young person who, I find this so fascinating, the parallels, this young man who was taken into custody yesterday because a McDonald's employee saw him and called police, based on the description that's been put out by NYPD and the FBI over the last few days of the manhunt. This young man is the same age as Daniel Penny, 26 years old. And look at the contrast of their lives. But then also look at the contrast of the response. Daniel Penny was actually protecting his fellow man, and he was participating in heroic actions. And people, especially BLM, are calling for vigilante justice, so-called justice, against him for protecting his fellow man, when they're now lauding this 26-year-old, Luigi Mangione is his name, Mangione, for enacting vigilante justice and committing the cold-blooded murder of a CEO of a giant healthcare corporation just because they disagree with how the healthcare industry is run in the United States. I mean, the comments and even the mainstream media articles that are now that they have apprehended Mangione and he's in custody, there are wide sweeping profiles of this guy that from, you know, from the Wall Street Journal to the Daily Mail to all of these other leftist headlines are fascinated with this guy's life and as if he's, you know, somebody that we need to study, and they are affirmatively comparing him to the Unabomber. I mean, it's utterly insane where we've gotten as a culture. And the Wall Street Journal actually says this, quote, he was held up, Mangione, as a folk hero by some for striking a blow against America's health insurers. And he turned out to be a high-achieving product of elite schools, an affluent Ivy Leaguer who harbored anti-capitalist leanings that may have played a role. This is insane. And so before we bring on our first guest, because I want to talk about this for a while this morning, because this really needs to be discussed, how our culture is just buying into this cultural Marxist nonsense. There is a book review that is supposedly by Mangione, and it's a book review of the Unabomber's manifesto. And it says this: when all other forms of communication fail, violence is necessary to survive. You may not like his methods, but to see things from his perspective, it's not terrorism, it's war and revolution. And then it goes on to say, these companies don't care about you or your kids or your grandkids. They have zero qualms about burning down the planet for a buck. So why should we have any qualms about burning them down to survive? Quote, violence never solved anything is a statement uttered by cowards and predators. I mean, this is this guy's worldview. And the comments on his X account are calling him based. They're saying, you know, we stand with you. You rendered a blow against, you know, the giant health corporation. Meanwhile, they're threatening Daniel Penny's life. I mean, this is entirely backward and completely utterly absurd. So let's bring in Orrin McIntyre, who has been waiting very patiently through my opening rant. And Orrin, you're a host and columnist at The Blaze. And what's your reaction to this contrast? I mean, it just, it's so incredibly interesting to me that, that these, both of these guys, 26-year-olds, are completely differently situated, and yet the reaction by an overwhelming segment of the public could not be more different and thoroughly upside down.
Yeah, as you said, it's very confusing. You have a scenario in which a man was defending himself and a train full of other people. And unfortunately, anytime you place yourself in a situation where violence has to be deployed for self-defense, there's always a possibility that someone could get injured or even killed. And that's obviously what happened here. But Daniel Penny was very clearly singled out, as you pointed out, because of his race. It's the optics of the situation. No one would have cared if a white hobo who had been on a subway had been harassing people and yelling at people and threatening people and then ended up getting restrained. That would have not been a story at all. But because there's a racial dynamic and there's grievance to peddle, Daniel Penny becomes a villain. The same we see with this healthcare assassination. Normally, people would be horrified by seeing someone gunned down, especially someone who is a rich, privileged kid gunning someone down in the middle of the street. We would be hearing about how this is his privilege and this is his, this is him taking advantage of the situation, thinking he's entitled to do whatever he wants. But because the person he shot was a healthcare CEO, and this dovetails into the less narrative, all of a sudden maybe the violence is something that we can celebrate. And so we see that there's no problem with vigilante justice on the left, and that's not what Daniel Penny was doing anyway. But they have no problem with people taking the law into their own hands or taking action at all. It really just matters whether or not the cause that they believe should be supported is being supported. It's not about the rule of law. It's not about some objective standard. It's about, is this person my friend or do I think this person is my enemy? And that's how I will judge whether their actions were right or wrong.
Yeah, and it's just, you're absolutely right. I mean, and this is all about the mindset and the worldview of oppressor versus oppressed, because when this BLM leader is calling for black vigilante action against Daniel Penny because they disagree with the jury verdict, or when all of these commenters are lauding the vigilante action of Mangione against the CEO healthcare worker, they're saying, well, that's good because he's the voice for us, the oppressed by the giant corporations and, you know, the evil capitalism that is America. And so we are descending rapidly into chaos. And what's remarkable about this to me as well is this isn't just, you know, some of our leaders are just, you know, some, you know, Al Sharpton ranting on MSNBC about it, and we can just kind of laugh him off a little bit. I mean, these are regular people who are responding to this and commenting with this kind of mentality that shows you that there is a large portion of the population that has bought into Marxism hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I think in the case of the healthcare CEO, there are a lot of people who are rightly frustrated at the American healthcare system. It is true that to a number of different situations inside the United States, we pay way more than any other people for the type of healthcare we receive. I don't think that means that we should be going around and shooting people. That's the problem, of course. It's okay to point out this problem in the healthcare system and that there's some deeply immoral actors inside, especially our medical insurance structure, while also understanding that that doesn't mean that you then have carte blanche to go and assassinate someone in the middle of the road. Same when it comes to the case of Daniel Penny. A lot of people, you know, problems with mental health. This man probably should have never been on the street. Neely, you know, his parents obviously didn't care about him. They're showing up to collect a payday at this point, but they didn't care about the man when he was wasting away on the streets. But that is no excuse for him then being able to harass other people, threaten other people, put other people's lives in danger. And it certainly doesn't mean we need to punish people who are protecting our way of life.
Yeah, and we're going to have to take a break here, but I'm going to keep Oren through the next segment because I want to talk about this more and the implications of our culture when we have this type of reaction to these two very different 26-year-olds. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are talking about Marxism that has pervaded and invaded our culture, and also about this whole idea of being a vigilante or someone who operates without legal authority, totally outside of the law and undertake law enforcement because they believe that the legal agencies are thought to be inadequate. And, you know, interestingly, we have examples in our media and our entertainment, our books and literature and so forth, of examples of vigilantes that are praised and they are lauded as heroes. I mean, I'm thinking of people, you know, like the characters like Batman, who works in tandem kind of with law enforcement, but really is a vigilante. And, you know, some of these myths have been part of our culture for a long time. And, you know, we see those types of heroes. And that's kind of the hero status that a lot of these responders are viewing Luigi Mangione, who is the now alleged killer of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. And if you go and look at his social media, there's a lot of, at least what appears to be his X account, there's a lot of content there that shows that he was a deep thinker, and he has a worldview. And I wonder, Oren McIntyre, who's my special guest this morning to discuss, how much this Ivy League sort of elite education has come into play, because we know that universities are basically indoctrination centers of Marxism. And we have, you know, at least one post that you and I were briefly discussing yesterday that Luigi Mangione actually posted on his X account, and a relevant read, "Christianity's Decline Has Unleashed Terrible New Gods." And he posts this this little snippet of it. Quote, "New atheism assumed that as people abandoned Christianity, they would embrace a sort of enlightened secular position. The death of Christian Scotland shows this was wrong. Faith there has been replaced by derangement, and the birthplace of the Scottish Enlightenment, which rose out of Christian principles, now worships intolerant new gods." And there are a lot of responders that say, oh, wow, imagine the conservatives now who are learning that the UnitedHealthcare CEO killer is a base right winger. Your response to that?
Yeah, this is always the game that's played after these kind of events. We try to piece together the ideology and see which team we can attribute to somebody. As you pointed out, the guy is an Ivy League educated guy. He's declared himself to be against capitalism. So how right wing is he? That's a question, but is he pointing out issues that modernity faces? Yes. And, you know, as you noted, he's well read on the several things, including, you know, the Ted Kaczynski's manifesto. And anybody who's ever read Ted Kaczynski's manifesto will recognize that while ultimately Kaczynski obviously was a criminal and somebody who had a terrible solution, he was recognizing in a very intelligent manner problems that did exist in modern society. The guy was a award-winning mathematician before he went insane. And so, you know, oftentimes in our culture, we tend to conflate evil intelligence and goodness. We say if someone is intelligent, then they must be good. If they are doing something evil, then they must be stupid or mentally ill. But the truth is that education doesn't necessarily always bring you to the correct conclusions. And so this man obviously is thinking through certain issues on a deep level. He is addressing problems that are real inside of modernity. I think that's why some people did resonate with the actions he took, but ultimately the actions he took were wrong. They were evil. They were not the way in which to resolve these problems. And so a lot of people will look into this and say, oh, well, he had a point about this and he had a point about that. Well, so did Ted Kaczynski, but that doesn't mean mailing bombs to people is okay, and it doesn't mean shooting people on the street is okay. You can recognize that someone understands a problem, but recognize that their solution is terrible.
That is a really great point, that we tend to equate intelligence in our society with goodness or expertise with and knowledge with, oh, okay, then they must arrive to the best conclusion. I mean, look no further than Anthony Fauci and everyone saying, well, since, you know, he's the head of the NIH, then what he suggests must be morally good, even though he himself admitted that there were white lies that he told. And I don't know how, you know, pure they really were, but that he told in the midst of the COVID response to get people to act the way that he wanted, because he believed in a certain outcome. And when we look at, you know, a lot of the people who, at least in a lot of, you know, literature and entertainment and movies and all of that, who are the evil characters, a lot of times they're kind of, you know, the bumbling fools. You do have the examples of the intelligent criminal mastermind. But with respect to this particular instance, a lot of people were suspecting and theorizing that it was going to be as simple as someone who, you know, a family member, maybe a spouse or a child, had been denied a healthcare claim. And so, you know, they took matters into their own hands, and it was out of, you know, sincere, just grief that they committed this atrocity, which in a rational person's mind is, well, absolutely morally wrong, because it's vigilante justice, which is not justice at all, and outside law and order, at least it's understandable. But here we have this guy who now it's all an exercise in his worldview. There's no, at least that we know of right now, personal connection. This is all just about his worldview ideology. And so it's raising a broader question about how we respond to problems in society. And I think that you're right to point out that even if the problems that he's addressing are problems, the solutions are not solutions. And that's becoming a real problem in our society today.
That's true. And again, we can't deplore, you know, we can't, you know, say that what he did was wrong. But I do think that there is something to learn here, again, not to validate any of his actions. But when people look at a healthcare CEO and they see somebody who is untouchable, who can get away with anything and do anything and be immoral and face no consequences, then we end up in this situation where people feel like the system cannot deliver justice. A lot of the left have really bought in to the idea that actually corporations can be on their side and can defend their interests. We've seen this with woke corporations, that they've been more than happy to double down on those, and they're not actually afraid of profits or capital as long as those things are defending a leftist worldview. And so a lot of Republicans would look at the ways that Democrats are abusing the system, the way that leftist billionaires are abusing the system, and say, this is a problem. And if these people are allowed to continue without consequences, they're allowed to hurt children and make money off of those kind of things, that's a terrible thing. You know, there are a lot of healthcare companies who are salivating at the chance to make money off of trans children because they thought of them as lifetime money dispensers because of their addiction to the pharmaceutical system. So it's not like these organizations are highly moral, and there's no point that people have when they point out their corruption. It's simply that we need to have a system that punishes this kind of behavior legally so that people do not feel like they need to resort to other methods. Again, in no way validating this man's actions, but there is a call for people to understand that these corporations are not on their side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm speaking with Orrin McIntyre, who is an author and host and columnist at The Blaze. And, you know, one of my favorite people to break down, you know, these types of worldview subjects, because Orrin, you know, what you're talking about also for everyone who's listening, and especially, you know, the AFR audience that is mostly conservative, mostly Christian. This raises an important question then when we're talking about, you know, the mindset when we feel like, okay, there are these major forces and, you know, elite institutions and groups that are untouchable. They can get away with everything and there's nothing that can be done to stop them. I would question then how many people have that same mentality when it comes to an event like January 6th, because that's exactly what Vivek Ramaswamy during the GOP primary was suggesting when the whole idea of pardons and all of that was initially raised. And I forget exactly where he said this comment. I think it was with the Tucker Carlson interview the family leader. But he said, basically, people didn't feel heard. And when you have institutions that are not accountable and people believe, right or wrong, but they believe that there is massive cheating going on, they believe that their vote doesn't count anymore, then when their claims are not redressable, which is a guarantee of the First Amendment, you get to the outcome like what we saw on January 6th. And while understandable, that I would simply submit to the audience here in the very same way is not in any way justifiable in terms of vigilante action within the same overall context of the conversation. And just because you may agree with the position of the overall J6ers, and again, you know, we're not talking about the individual differences. There were some people that didn't commit any sort of criminal action. There were some that absolutely were over-prosecuted, you know, and all of those things need to be parsed out, definitely, and I hope that President Trump will do that. But when we're talking about just, you know, issuing a blanket pardon and saying all of those actions were justifiable because, you know, we weren't heard, that's actually the same mentality as these people who are lauding the CEO killer. And I'm not equating, you know, the two outcomes, but I'm saying in terms of the mentality of vigilante action, when you feel that the process is suppressing the redressability of your claim, we all need to look at that, because there are more and more and more instances now in recent American history that both sides have justified because they want to be heard and because the actors, they feel, represent their own claim.
Yeah, you're right that the mentalities are similar, but let's also not forget that these are similar mentalities that led to the American Revolution, right? The central claim of the philosopher John Locke, to whom, you know, the founders were referring in the Declaration of Independence, is that a government that refuses to redress your grievances is no government at all. And when he makes his famous statement about an appeal to heaven, he is talking about the right of a people to revolt against a government that is tyrannical. Now, we can very much point out that perhaps not all recourses had been exhausted before the January 6th protest, and therefore those involved were not justified in their action. And I think there's probably a good merit, you know, good point to be made there. But we also cannot ignore the fact that we live in a country that was founded on the principle of the idea that if a government refuses to listen to legitimate questions of the people, especially when it comes to elections, deciding who will represent them, how can you have a government of the people if you do not have legitimate elections? So it's not that there is never a reason to take these kind of actions, and conservatives do need to be careful about that, because while it is absolutely correct that we need to live as much as possible under governance and under law and order, there is a point at which governments no longer serve the purpose of the people. And if our government has reached that point, and I don't believe it has, and I don't believe we're justified taking any of those actions at this time, but if a government did reach there, we can't pretend like those options are off the table. And so I think it behooves the government and the people who, the elite class that controls a lot of the government that we now are observing, they have to start listening to the people, not because I want any form of revolution, but because they will be basically demanding it from the people under the logic of the founders themselves. And so I think that it's important to remember that while we can look at the actions of January 6th protesters that got out of hand and say, this was not the time, you had not reached a threshold of justification, it is not that that justification doesn't exist. And it's not as if our government was not on a path heading towards that before the election of Donald Trump.
And this is where, and I think you're right to say that that threshold is the seminal question. And that has been the question that has been debated throughout certainly American history, but throughout, I think, world history. Where does the right of revolution and the morality of civil disobedience attach? And there, that does need to be an objective threshold morally, but it is also subjective in terms of just the context is going to look different, obviously, in 1776 than it does in 2021. And you're right to say that the Declaration specifically says, in every stage of these oppressions, and the founders listed all of their grievances. They said, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, it is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And so they went and declared the right of revolution. And it's been debated throughout American history, where some people would say, that rebellion was morally unjustified. And the only reason that we as Americans are advocating that it was a good thing is because of the outcome. And history would look a lot different if the founders had not been successful in their revolution, and how might we have looked back on that? And this is why, all of these questions are very complex, and we only have, about 40 minutes here in the beginning to address these. But what I want you to take away as a listener is to understand what Oren just said is very important. There is a bright line threshold that has to be crossed, and we should not immediately go to vigilante action. We should always look at when the moral right of revolution or civil disobedience attaches. And we need to understand these from a moral, principled, and biblical perspective. And so, Oren, as we're looking at this, and I think more and more people feel more and more detached from a government that truly represents them, where does the mandate for Trump now fit into all of this when we're looking at the differences between the response to, Daniel Penny calling for black vigilante action, the response to the CEO killer saying, great, lauding you as a vigilante, and then looking even some conservatives at January 6th and saying nobody did anything wrong there, pro-vigilante action there. I mean, a lot of this is more complex than just, hey, I agree with their motives, therefore they were justified.
Well, I think the big thing for Donald Trump is going to be the need to restore faith in our process and in our institutions. And what that's going to require in the case of many of these institutions is for them to be dismantled. They're simply too corrupt. It's very clear to the people that they are abusing their powers and their abilities. And if they're not dismantled, they need to be thoroughly restaffed and restructured. We need to see people held accountable so that we can trust public health agencies again, so that we can trust law enforcement agencies again, so that we can trust educational institutions again. But the only way that happens is very, very radical cuts, deconstructions and reconstructions. A lot of people also need to see that law and order is going to be restored. We need to know that these, that sanctuary cities are not going to be able to harbor criminals and throw off our law. We need to know that people are not going to go to jail because they protected themselves against somebody with the wrong skin color. These are the kinds of things that build up tension inside a society and make them people believe that there is no justice, that there is no safety, and that they have to take things into their own hands. The problem is not with the people in this sense, though I do think there is a problem with, you know, as you pointed out, some of the Marxist narratives that get moved around. But really, this is a failure of the government to do its job. And if the government would do its job better, fewer and fewer people would be resorting to these crackpot theories that they're picking up online. That doesn't excuse their actions. But central to this, we need to build government trust if we're going to see any of this abate.
So well said, and you can follow Orrin McIntyre on X. And I'm reminded of the John Adams quote that said, "Our Constitution was made only for immoral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Morality and virtue are the foundation of our republic and necessary for a society to be free. We need to go back to morality and virtue in our institutions." We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then, they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one last comment on this. I got an email during the break from a listener named Jerry, who said this: "Jenna, we need to be careful using the word vigilante in every and any scenario. It is only vigilante when the person getting taken out is a bad person or a criminal. The assassination of the CEO was not a vigilante type act. It was murder. Superman was never after a law-abiding citizen." And that's a great comment, and obviously that's correct, but the point of this is that the CEO killer and those who support him believe that he's a vigilante because they believe that the CEO, Brian Thompson, was an evil and bad person. And so thus, we have to always parse this out based on moral and objective truth, not subjectively whether we agree or disagree with the worldview and the mindset of the actor and the person who's attempting to carry out the vigilante act, and say that they were justified or not based on our own belief of whether the target was evil or not. So good comment, Jerry. And you can always reach me, by the way, for comments, either on social media, but the best way for me and my team is jenna@afr.net. But let's turn to our good friend Mark Lauder, who is the Chief Communications Officer at the America First Policy Institute. And Mark, good morning. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering where we sit with, as kind of a nation here, and as where the Republican Party sits with Donald Trump taking a lot of people into his administration from key positions like the governors of South Dakota, North Dakota, possibly Governor Ron DeSantis out of Florida, key senators, key representatives. Where do we stand in terms of filling some of these positions in the GOP?
Well, good morning, Jenna. It's actually my hope that, much like the selection of J.D. Vance as vice president, President-elect Trump is actually setting the stage for the next generation of America First leadership. Obviously, he did so with one of the youngest vice presidents in history. And what I would hope is as we start to see some of these other positions filled, whether it's lieutenant governors, whether it's Senate, whether it's congressional members that are newly going to be elected, that we're actually going to start to see another generation of America First leaders, younger leaders, rising up, gaining their experience, whether it's on the Hill or in the governor's mansion, that then can go on to lead the party for maybe decades to come.
Yeah, and you know, and that's a great point as well, that J.D. Vance's seat in Ohio is going to have to be replaced. And there was, you know, a poll recently that suggested that LaRose, who is the current Secretary of State of Ohio, is at least the top contender for that. And, you know, we'll see how that happens. But in terms of kind of, you know, the up and coming generation, you know, who are we looking at potentially for some of these key spots?
Well, you know, obviously in some cases it's going to be obviously decided if it's a governor, the lieutenant governor is generally the one that's going to replace that person in office. But I'm hoping that these governors who suddenly have these seats to fill, whether it's in the Senate or obviously setting special elections, and the voters go, okay, great. You know, now's the time to start to see the change, whether it's in the Senate, whether it's in the House of Representatives. We get to usher in a new level of leadership that we may not have seen before. And so I think that's a very unique opportunity for Donald Trump to put his stamp on the party long after he has actually left office.
Yeah, absolutely. And so can we expect, do you think, Trump to weigh in on, you know, some of these nominations, and obviously the biggest one so far has been a lot of this talk surrounding the potential appointment of Laura Trump to the Senate from Florida. And of course, Governor DeSantis has that ability to appoint a person to fill Rubio's seat for at least the next 2 years until a special election is called for the remainder of the term until and so where do we stand on something like that, where we know Trump has at least weighed in on that? Is he going to weigh in on some of these others? And do we have Mark Lauder? Oh, yep. There we go. We got you.
Yeah, there we are. Ultimately, I'm backing into a parking spot. Ultimately, you know, it's going to be Governor Ron DeSantis' decision. But, you know, I love obviously the idea of Laura Trump filling that role, not only because she's an America First patriot, she's a warrior, but also, this is going to be one of the top seats that are going to be targeted by the Democrats in 2026. Florida is not a cheap state to run in. There are a lot of very expensive media markets there. So the nominee is ultimately going to have to be able to raise a large sum of money in a very quick time period. And I think Laura's time, not only as the RNC co-chair, but on 2020, on the 2016 campaigns, puts her in a very strong position to be able to do that.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was interesting that she left her position and resigned from the RNC as the co-chair yesterday. Is that to further kind of, you know, put up the media sort of pressure campaign to say, you know, hey, I'm ready to take this open seat?
Well, I think so. And obviously, it's a challenging to try to be the nominee or to be the senator elect or designate when you're still chairing the political party. So I think obviously doing this, but also gave way for Michael Whatley to take leadership. I think the president has already suggested that someone else be elevated to co-chair. So again, it's setting the stage for that next generation of leadership, letting them hit the ground running. Technically, Marco Rubio still needs to resign. And so once that happens, then the wheels go in motion for that position to be filled.
And so what about some of these other key positions like, you know, the governorships? At least currently, we know Kristi Noem and Doug Burgum have been nominated. Neither, to my knowledge, have actually resigned their positions yet. What happens in those states, and what elections or special elections should we be watching?
Well, I'm not really up to complete speed on all the state laws and all of them, but generally
speaking, because they're different, right?
Yeah, Yeah, generally speaking, the lieutenant governor fills out the remainder of the term, so there would not be a special election. Now, there could be some obviously unique circumstances in South Dakota and in North Dakota for those two governors. But as a general rule, the lieutenant governor just assumes that seat and fills out the remainder of their term. Then they would be eligible to be to run for reelection. And obviously, each state's a little unique in terms of how many terms they could go seek.
Right, right. And so, and that's a great point, Mark Lauder, that, you know, there are a lot of different rules that govern different states because, of course, each state is different. And this is why we have what's called the 50 laboratories of democracy. And so even, you know, when it comes to the replacement of, you know, of senators, when it comes to the replacement of representatives, and at least on the congressional level as well, I mean, there have been a number of GOP leaders that have been at least nominated, like Elise Stefanik, you know, some of those. Are there any of these positions that will have special elections that we should be concerned about, you know, potentially going to a Democrat or, you know, shifting the balance or the composition of the Congress? Because, you know, while the Republicans have the trifecta, it's not by a huge margin.
No, and generally, again, generally speaking, House seats are filled by special elections. The governor calls the special election. I believe in each of the instances where the president-elect has tapped a member of Congress, those are all considered very safe seats. So unless you would get someone who is deeply flawed or have significant issues that did not come up in a shortened primary that would get the nomination, I think it would be very highly unlikely that a Democrat would be able to take any of those congressional seats. I believe those are all fairly safe seats that the president has picked from.
And I'm speaking with Mark Lauder, who is the Chief Communications Officer at the America First Policy Institute. And there have been a number of, you know, significant positions even within AFPI, like Brooke Rollins, you know, and others who are now nominees in the second Trump administration. So what about your own organization there? You know, is AFPI just kind of the bare bones now that everybody's leaving?
No, not even close. You know, obviously it's an embarrassment of riches that I believe we have at least 12 people who are being pulled from our ranks to either be cabinet level officials or senior White House and administration officials. But, you know, that was something that we had taken into the planning a long time ago, hoping that something like this would happen. You know, we're already being inundated with folks who want to come in, want to join the organization, maybe put themselves, you know, in position. Should there be, obviously, in a year or two down the road, other positions that need to be filled? But the one thing I can tell you is Brooke Rollins has been very clear from the beginning that we were not building this organization for just the next election or a specific candidate, but really looking to build like a 100-year organization that could help shape the future of America First for a long time to come.
Yeah, and that's a great point because, you know, America First, while that's, you know, tied as sort of a campaign slogan to Donald Trump and his candidacy, there's so much in the conservative world that wants that to be a lasting kind of legacy and forward progress for the whole conservative movement as a whole. And so in the last few minutes I have with you, Mark Lauder, you know, we're looking now next already, you know, if I can dare speak of the midterms and, you know, right on the heels of this last election. I know, right? I know. He's going to text me like, you know, kinds of, how dare you after the program, but you know, looking at that, are we in a good position, we the conservative movement, to build upon the wins and the mandates of 2024 and on the utter rejection of the leftist nonsense?
Well, I would say yes right now, but with a big caveat. You know, two things I think have to happen. Number one, I think the president's agenda needs to be enacted, and if they do that, and if there is a lot of success, whether it's securing the border, lowering prices, dealing with the world that is spinning out of control, then I think the American people will reward the America First movement and grow on those majorities that we currently have. If for some reason, you know, his agenda is blocked, it's not widely enacted or it's drastically watered down, I think you're going to see a lot of people in the America First movement want to see change, which could ultimately change the current composition of our leadership on the Hill, but also set the stage for next cycle. Ultimately, the Democrats have got to figure out where they're going to go. I mean, are they going to continue to be owned by the radical, woke, anti-Semitic left? Or are they going to try to pivot back to the middle? If they continue down their path with the radical left, I think you're going to see even more defections, even more and larger America First majorities. But if they move back to the middle, well, then game on. We'll see how it goes.
All right. But, if they move back to the middle, that's better than being extreme leftist. And, you even saw here in the state of Florida, one of the Democrat state representatives who changed her party affiliation from Democrat to Republican to join the supermajority in Florida. So, it's happening. People are waking up to conservative principles. Mark Lauder, thanks. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.